Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, for this year's keynote on Linux Tag 2006. Well, I'm quite impressed, so many people here in the keynote. I'm very happy to learn something new about the Linux distribution market. We've seen in recent times some major changes in the way we see Linux, and I think Ubuntu and the several derivatives that exist of Ubuntu have a major share of this new feeling towards Linux. So I'm very happy to have Mark Shuttleworth with us today. Mark is the founder, the inventor. What is the precise description? I think he'll tell us. So please welcome with me Mr. Mark Shuttleworth.
Thank you very much. So I think maybe the best word for me would be dreamer, like chief dreamer at Ubuntu. It really is a great privilege to be here. This is in many ways the epicenter, right? This is the event at which we get internationally recognized interaction between the community, people who actually really drive the free software movement, people who give it its energy, give it its life, give it its vision, give it its future, and the commercial sector, people who deliver results, who present us with contractual interfaces, people with whom we can reach agreements to actually get work done. And it's very important to me that we continue to inject into the free software world an understanding of the importance of both of these dimensions. And when people ask me, what was the vision behind Ubuntu? What was the real dream in Ubuntu? The dream was to do exactly what I see you guys doing right here at LinuxTag. Bring together the ethics, the values, the philosophy of the free software movement, which I think is one of the most powerful things to happen in the last 30 years globally. Bring together those values, those ethics, with commercial predictability, reliability, sustainability, and so on. I believe that if we can bring these two ideas together, we can create something new, which will not simply equal what has gone before, but which will effectively give us all a new roadmap, a new direction for computing and for software on the desktop and in the server. So that really was the vision behind Ubuntu. I call it delivering on the promise of free software. If you want to step back and look philosophically at what's going on in the world, we're actually seeing a new way of interacting, a new way of building things emerge. And we're seeing that first in the software industry. The free software movement effectively was the first expression of this. But we're seeing the ripple effects of that idea spreading into all sorts of other industries. We're seeing those ripple effects spread into the media industry. We're seeing the ripple effects spread into the knowledge industry. If you look at what's happening between Wikipedia and the traditional reference textbooks, right, the people who supposedly spoke for humanity in terms of knowledge, we're seeing that the Wikipedia approach, a collective, contributory, participatory approach, can generate results that are absolutely astounding, that are new, that are fresh, that cause everybody to stop and reevaluate and think again about business models and opportunities and an entire industry. So I think what we are effectively in the free software movement, we are the thin edge of the wedge of a participation revolution, a revolution where expertise bubbles to the top, not because it moves up through a corporate ladder, but because it gathers support within a community for an idea and eventually projects that out into the world using the internet as a universal communications medium. Okay. So before I get too philosophical about the big picture of what's going on, I want to talk about Ubuntu and about the free software movement and about how these things come together. To me, this is about delivering on the promise of free software. If we look at what the Free Software Foundation and what the early pioneers of free software set out to do 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, I believe that it's only now that we're really starting to deliver that promise to end users around the world. The free software world is different. it requires a different approach, right? The economics are different. I believe that we can make high-quality desktop software freely available, right, at zero cost. I believe that we can do that without compromising the values of the free software movement. And I believe that we can do that while still providing something that is of commercial levels of integrity, with security updates, with commercial support. So something that would make Richard Stallman happy, but equally well, something that will make a chief information officer at Deutsche Bank very happy. If we can bring together these two ways of looking at the world, we can produce something that's unique and powerful. I think if we're going to do that, then we have to embrace a different kind of culture, right? We have to make the cultural thinking of the free software movement pervasive, right? That means that we have to relinquish control to a certain extent of the platform. Now, that goes against the grain of anything that's been done before in the industry. Typically, what organizations try to do is control the platform. What we believe is that you actually have to relinquish control of the platform. You have to create community governance structures. You have to say that even if I'm the primary funder of the platform, I don't get to say everything that goes into the distro or everything that doesn't go in. We create community governance structures which allow anybody on merit effectively to take a leadership position in the distribution and lead, whether that's a particular part of code or whether that's a particular part of the documentation or whether that's a particular part of the artwork or the translation, any aspect of the platform that we all share the benefits of. Open that participation at all levels and make sure that when you do drive forward and take decisions and operate in an executive commercial kind of fashion, that you do so completely transparently. And so within the Ubuntu project, we've tried to embrace all of those values. We work in a public forum. There are no decisions taken without that are not open to community participation. And that's actually been extremely difficult for us. We realized that last year, in 2005, we had one meeting where the employees of Canonical were present and nobody else was present. We had literally 1 hour when we were together as a company. And most of it was spent just sort of bonding as a company. So everything that happens in this transparent, open kind of fashion. The vision is to build a community-driven distribution, which in fact turns into multiple community-driven distributions, which can grow and sustain themselves for the long term. Okay. So what is the proposition? What do we believe that people should feel that they can get from this platform, a platform for the 21st century, right? First, it should have all the characteristics of free software. It should have genuine freedom and flexibility. That means that you shouldn't have to pay a licensing fee for it. You shouldn't have to pay for support. If you want to go to the community for support, do that. If you want to go to any company for support, do that, right? But at the same time, it should have all of the qualities of a commercial product: superb commercial technical support, certification of hardware, certification of software, ISV certification, certification of skills, so that engineers, system administrators, organizations can build a certified knowledge base effectively around it. Standards compliance, things like the LSB, the work of the Free Standards Group, really we believe are the glue that will bind this community together in the long term. Internationalization and customization. We have to produce a platform which is equally good for someone in Cambodia as it is for someone here in Wiesbaden. We have to build a platform which is equally good for somebody who has a disability as it is for somebody who doesn't. And if we do that and we give them the ability to customize that platform, then we give them something that is genuinely new and genuinely outstanding. Professionalism, security, and stability. We have this free platform has to be secure. You have to be able to deploy it with confidence on network-facing servers and network-facing desktops. And we have to fundamentally embrace this idea of collaboration. I believe collaboration is kind of the fuel that drives the free software movement. It's the fuel that drives any kind of participation-driven activity like Wikipedia or the open content movement. So one of the questions that I always get asked is free software ready for the desktop? And my answer to that is absolutely yes for some people. And it's kind of a cop-out answer, isn't it? So I have a lot of people come up to me and say, so convince me to switch from Windows. I don't bother, right? That's a very short conversation. I'll say, stay with Windows, and then I could do something more interesting, right? Because if Windows is the right platform for you, then you should stay on Windows. And if the Mac is the right platform for you, then you should stay on the Mac, right? However, it is, of course, important always to know what all of your options are. And what I absolutely believe is that if you look at a large organization today, you will find big chunks of the organization, big chunks of the desktop users within the organization, who absolutely are ready for Linux on the desktop, right? I was chatting to somebody today about a big project in South Africa. I'm South African, and it happens to be that this project is from South Africa, where one of the government departments has realized that they have 8,000 or 9,000 people, all of whom spend all of their day on the web, doing email, and accessing a mainframe through a terminal application. And surprise, surprise, you can do all three of those things just as well, if not better, on Linux than you can on Windows. So for those several thousand users, there is absolutely no doubt that Linux is a perfectly viable and good platform. So Linux is ready for the desktop for them. If you go to Brazil, you'll find that probably about 20% of computers today ship with Linux. Most of those, get converted to Windows machines afterwards. But there are still about 7% of desktop users out there who are perfectly happy using Linux on the desktop. If you go to China, you will find that the government will tell you that they have committed by 2010 to have 100% of their IT acquisitions based on Linux of one form or another, because they believe that they have to absolutely energize their economy, get their economy running on free software, because that's the best way for them to get Chinese companies able to compete technologically at the very highest levels globally without having to go through a 30-40 year development cycle. So yes, free software is ready for widespread adoption on the desktop if you meet certain requirements. And to me, this is then straightforwardly just an economic analysis type of question, right? At what point does it become economically viable for an organization of 20,000 desktops to move the X thousand desktops that would work with Linux onto Linux? That's a very different question to the thing that we're facing, for example, in Munich, where the challenge is to move an entire organization, right? Where you have to take care of every peripheral, every consumer application, every custom application. That's a much more complex challenge than simply within a large organization finding a slice which will work very efficiently and can be managed very efficiently on Linux. And I would urge you, when you talk about free software to people, not to try to convert people who don't want to be converted, but instead to look for the opportunities where there are people who are ready to make this move and to help them make a success of that move. Because it's success building on success that will actually turn this into a snowball. So we've been working for 2 years on this vision, and this is really what most of you will think of as Ubuntu today, right? A very popular desktop platform, which has this key characteristics of trying to be easy to use and just working the way desktop users want. That is a complete environment. It's not a huge environment. If you look at Ubuntu, you'll see that we go through it to a huge amount of effort to simplify it, right? We ship one browser. It's very tempting to ship two because we live, you know, in both the GNOME environment and the KDE environment, we have Firefox, which is kind of a universal platform, and then we have a browser which is more tuned to that particular desktop. So it's very tempting, it's a very difficult decision for us to cut it down to one, but we absolutely believe cut it down and focus, give users something that is complete but straightforward to figure out what they should be doing to achieve any particular task. Internet, email, chat, web, office, all the sorts of things that typical users need from a desktop, right? With free security updates and extensive local language support. That's where we started. It's now turned into a much more diverse project, right? All kinds of desktops. Ubuntu, which is GNOME-based. Kubuntu, which is KDE-based. And now Zubuntu, which is XFCE-based. And I think we're going to start to see more specialization with projects like Edubuntu, which are focusing on specific vertical markets like education. So Edubuntu is focused on what do you need in a digital classroom? What is the ideal environment for a digital classroom? And it turns out that the ideal environment for a digital classroom is not GNOME-based or KDE-based or XFCE-based. It's a mix of all of those things. Because if you want the very best in educational applications, you have to be able... It's getting really hot in here. You have to be able to live across both of those platforms. So... Here's something that I came specifically to Wiesbaden today to communicate. And that is that Kubuntu, and KDE. So do you want me to stop there, or do I get to keep going? I need a bit of background music if I'm going to do this properly. and a poll, maybe. Yeah. So KDE and Kubuntu are an essential part of the free desktop platform of the future, right? Why is that? I don't know. But it is, right? I don't get to choose for end users what platform they should use. Free software is all about having that kind of choice for yourself. And yes, there are frustrations, right? I get calls from big companies every day saying, geez, should we develop something for Ubuntu or for Kubuntu? I say, you figure that out. Go talk to your users, right? These rich, sophisticated environments both exist for a reason. We have passionate developers, we have passionate users, strong communities on both sides. And my belief is that what we want to do is empower those communities to do their very best work and publish their very best work so that users can make the right choice for themselves. So this is an opportunity for us to create both independence, right? Instead of shoehorning these two desktop environments into one platform where you end up with something that feels suboptimal to everyone, right? You end up with KDE developers who are pissed off because it's half GNOME, and GNOME developers who are pissed off because it's half KDE. Instead of doing that, let's just let both environments evolve, compete, be independent, but also create opportunities for collaboration, because there is a tremendous amount of shared infrastructure. And the better the conversation we can have about that shared infrastructure, the better for both individual platforms and the better for the free software community at large. Okay, so this, from an Ubuntu project perspective, the next couple of months really are prime time for KDE and for Kubuntu. We've put in a lot of work for this next release, which goes out on June 1st, to elevate Kubuntu in as many ways as we can to being as equally supported, as equally published, as equally blogged about, as equally treated as a distro as the traditional Ubuntu GNOME-based desktop. So we will be doing CD shipments of Kubuntu for Dapper. So we will make it available to people worldwide on the same basis for download through retail channels and through our shipping program. We've built support for KDE applications into Rosetta, which is our web-based translation application. I'll show you a bit more of that later. We're starting to figure out how to make our Launchpad bug tracking application, which is, I think, unique in the world in the sense that it's designed to link between bug trackers, right? It's designed to allow us to keep track of Ubuntu bugs, but when we find a bug that actually is in a GNOME library, we can go over to the GNOME guy and say, hey, we found this bug. We'll connect it to your bug tracker over here. And then in our bug tracker, we can constantly see the statuses of that bug in upstream or in other distributions. If they fix it, then we're able to quickly go and find the fix and bring that fix into Ubuntu, and vice versa. If we fix one of those bugs, then the KDE developers are able to get notified that we fixed it, come and find the patch, and pull that into upstream. We're attempting to integrate early some of the ideas that I think are going to be exciting about KDE 4. And so while it's still very, very early days, I hope that our next release will really demonstrate some of the road ahead for KDE. And so system settings and the guidance configuration system, those are both already in Kubuntu. And hopefully those will become more popular later. So there's another desktop that's emerging, and we haven't yet given this one the same level of prominence as we've given Kubuntu, and that is Zubuntu, which is XFCE-based. XFCE is enormously popular in environments where you're dealing with low-power computing, or where you need all of your performance to go to some specific application. So I was just chatting with Mark, I think it was, from New Thinking, and he's building a platform around XFCE and around Zubuntu, which is optimized for real-time multimedia recording. And he doesn't want the desktop environment, effectively, to get in the way of his ability to do real-time recording-type applications. And so Zubuntu is a great starting point, a great platform for that. Okay, we started on the desktop. The vision is free software computing for everybody. And most people who use computers use desktop computers. So that's the part that we had to try and get right first. And while we're not fully there yet, you know, we we are not the right desktop for everybody, right? There is still an argument for Windows in some cases and Mac in some cases. While we're not there yet, it is now time for us also to generalize that and to try and bring some of the philosophy, that just works kind of philosophy, the reliability, stability, and the freedom to the server kind of environment as well. And so a big focus for us with version 6.06 LTS, long-term support, which is due out on June 1st, is the server environment as well. We'll support this release for 5 years on the server. 5 years is long enough for us to start to work with some of the bigger ISVs, Oracle and others. We can't even start to have that conversation about those certifications unless we can support the release for that sort of length of time. So it'll come in both server and desktop editions, lots of certification of enterprise software, and then we're also starting to certify skills and hardware. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to announce a comprehensive server certification program with one of the five largest hardware vendors in the world, which I'm very excited about. It's been a long road to get us to that point. But what this now starts to mean is that people can buy servers and have support for the server, certified with support for the operating system, certified with support for their applications using Ubuntu and Kubuntu. Pre-installation is also obviously more and more of a feature for us. We have worked to simplify the installation, but most people who use computers do not want to install operating systems. So we have to start making it possible for people to buy computers with the operating system already pre-installed. And so that's quite a lot of our work. These are three examples of fairly high-end software which Dapper will include, will out of the box be certified on. And we hope that we can expand that list up the application stack, particularly on the enterprise server side. In terms of skills certification, we just announced with the LPI that there is now an Ubuntu Certified Engineer program, which is built on top of LPI's qualification. I saw that there's some LPI tests and exams going on downstairs as well. And that will be globally available as soon as Dapper goes out the door. So, how do we actually power this? How do we make an environment like this continue to stay healthy? And to me, it all boils down to the kinds of relationships that you have with different groups, right? So we have one set of relationships with users, and we have to have a clear idea about what's important to those users. And these are the sort of our headline items. These are the things that we think users really, really care about, right? Simplicity. Right, end users want to be productive. They want to, right out of the box, be able to figure out how to do what they need to do, and make it sort of work the way they expect it to work. When you plug in a camera, you should get a photography management application. When you plug in a file store, you should see your files immediately appearing. Crisp and clutter-free. This is perhaps the most difficult thing for us to do in the free software world because there are so many options. Right? I mean, the wonderful thing about the free software world is there are three or four different ways to transcode MP3s into OGG files. Right? And part of the challenge for us is that as a community, we tend to divide ourselves. So when someone comes up and says, well, I need to do this, they get three different opinions from three different users as to how they should get something done. And while that creates diversity and richness, it also means that that user is often then not sure as to which is the best way to go forward in doing things. So keeping things crisp is a big challenge, but something that we set as a goal for Ubuntu, for Kubuntu, and for Zubuntu. Keeping things current, right? Making sure that, especially in the world of the desktop, where the software is changing so fast, that people can know when they're going to get an extra release, what features will be in it, and what date it will ship on. Those things are really, really important. And then keeping things comprehensive so that if we didn't make the right choice for somebody, that they can trivially go out there and pull in any other application that exists in the free software world and which they might want to use. Business relationships are equally important to us, right? We have to create an ecosystem of companies that provide support, companies that provide training, companies that provide certified solutions. And the only way you do that is if you invite large numbers of organizations in and give them an opportunity both to help shape the direction of the platform and to build their own economic models around that. So that's very, very important. And we now have, I think, 250, 300 companies around the world that declare themselves to offer solutions or services or products or consulting or training or something like that associated with Ubuntu. And I think the strength of the platform is very much going to be determined by the strength of this ecosystem, right? The stronger we can make an ecosystem like that, the more robust the platform becomes for everybody. And then these are, I think, our most important relationships. The relationship that we maintain with the free software community, right? And that consists of upstream. In the GNOME case, it's the GNOME upstreams, KDE upstreams, Apache, Firefox, Mozilla, all of those different groups effectively. They write the code. We integrate the code. And so to the extent that we can have a healthy relationship, we can help them with bug triaging, right? We get a lot of bug reports that are actually bug reports in Firefox. But we can feed the Firefox developers bug reports that have already been annotated and checked out and looked for duplicates and so on. So we can actually be a rich source of information about quality assurance to those upstreams. In return, they are best suited and best able to know what features we should be able to expect at a particular time, what bugs we can get fixed at a particular time. So this is a potential for good collaboration. Other distributions. Obviously, the most important distro relationship for us is our relationship with Debian. We are part of that broader Debian family, right? And so we try very hard to make sure that when we upload a package, the Debian maintainer can trivially click somewhere and see a list of the changes that we've made, because that maximally increases the chances that he'll say, yeah, I agree with that change, I agree with this change, I'll bring those in. And so we're able to power ahead and really optimize the platform for these kinds of specific use cases. And the Debian maintainers are able to bring in those changes into the general case of Debian where it makes sense for them and ignore the changes that are not useful for them. But we also want to maintain equally good relationships with SUSE, with Red Hat, with the Fedora teams and communities and so on, so that good work that we do can flow to them and vice versa. Good work that they do, we are able to go in and fetch and integrate into Ubuntu. So that ultimately Ubuntu starts to come to represent the very best free software work wherever it's being done, whether it's being done upstream or in a distribution. And our work becomes as accessible to other people in the best way possible. Okay, so DAPA comes out on June 1st. And the focus for that has all been reliability, predictability, support. So essentially we've allowed the pendulum to swing to the enterprise side of things. Now we want the pendulum to swing back, and we want to swing back hard and fast, effectively. So from in the 4 months after we release DAPA, we unleash our developers on all of the bleeding edge crack that is out there and coming down the pike. So the idea is effectively to say to our developers, you've done incredibly well over the last 8 months producing DAPA. Now go out there and lay the foundations for the next wave of technological innovation, right? And so that means that fundamentally that release is going to be less stable than DAPA is. And I don't see that as a bad thing. We have the stable enterprise quality release that's out there that will be out there for 5 years on the server. Now we should be going out there and finding the hottest, most exciting next generation technology and bringing it in. And then over the next couple of releases, basically polishing and maturing that technology to the point where we can do another enterprise grade release in 18 months or 2 years or 3 years. So what sorts of things will be in there? Well, the first thing I should say is I can't make any guarantees, because I've explicitly said I'm not going to tell anybody what to do. The developers get to nominate and propose all the things that are really interesting to them, and all I get to do is to help choose, effectively, which things will go into that. But here are the things that I think are likely to get in. Virtualization. Virtualization is the most extraordinary technology to come out in the last 2 years, I think, because it fundamentally changes the way people think about resource utilization, resource allocation, right? It started on the server, where you might have 50 servers in a bunch of racks and cabinets, most of which are hardly working at all. But you want to have a separate machine for your domain name servers and everything else, to the machine that you have your mail servers on, to the machine that you have your database servers on, and the machine that you have your web servers on. And it turns out that your domain name server is hardly doing anything, right? But you want it on its own machine because it's exposed to the network. Well, using virtualization, you're able to run that virtual machine effectively on the same piece of hardware as you're running other virtual machines, which are also pretty lazy. Or not very busy. So it makes an enormous amount of sense on the server side of things. Xen is probably the leading candidate right now for virtualization support in Edgy. But we'd like that to be general, and I'm very encouraged by the idea that we could get to a standardized API which works well with VMware, which works well with Xen, and which works well potentially with other virtualization providers, so that you can choose the virtualization approach or platform that you want to use with Edgy. We'll see. It's going to depend on what the developers think is the most exciting, most interesting, most best trajectory kind of technology. On the GUI front, Microsoft and Apple really have laid down a big challenge to us, because they've started to make this transition from a 2D kind of environment to a 3D kind of environment, adding extra dimensionality. So if you've seen transparency type effects, that's all being driven by this extra dimensionality that we're getting into the desktop. If you've seen those fancy effects where Windows essentially tile themselves and move around and change shape, that's all being driven by this extra dimensionality. And we will try and integrate that technology into Edgy. We don't believe that is ready for production use, so it can't go into Dapper. But we do think it's a perfect kind of thing to include in Edgy, because we'll be able to do it, we'll be able to integrate it well. We can start effectively learning how you do a desktop in more than two dimensions. And so I hope that over the next 2 or 3 years, we'll be able to leapfrog Microsoft, leapfrog Apple, and deliver a desktop which really gives us extraordinary productivity and functionality and bling. Multi-arch. So right now we have 64-bit computers and 32-bit computers. And the reality is that we're not making the full use of the feature that many of those 64-bit computers have to be able to run both 64-bit and 32-bit code at the same time. So for example, if you've got a desktop that's also serving as a database, you want to have a 64-bit database, because you want to have very fast access to all of your RAM, right? Very efficient access to all of your RAM. But you don't really want a 64-bit text editor, right? Unless it's Emacs, maybe. You don't really want to have a 64-bit LS command. So you want to really have a mixed environment, 32-bit and 64-bit. So this is one of the great engineering challenges that we face, effectively, is to teach the operating system to know at a core level what applications are 64-bit, what applications are 32-bit, and let you mix and match those on the same machine. So you might start out with a 32, you know, start out with an install, and by default, most of the applications there will be 32-bit. You bring in a database, and that's a 64-bit database, and it needs a bunch of libraries, which you already have, but you've got the 32-bit versions of those libraries. So the operating system needs to be able to fetch in the 64-bit versions of those libraries. So you can have a 32-bit OpenOffice and a 64-bit Postgres running on the same machine. So that's one of the big sort of engineering challenges that I think we have over the next 2 or 3 years, and I'd like to get started with that. And then improved package management. You know, Debian really set the standard early on for package management, both in terms of the core packaging itself and how a package described itself in its dependencies, and the management layer that you wrap around that, in terms of how to resolve those dependencies, how best to transition your machine, how to upgrade a machine from one release to the next. And I think it's time to inject a whole new energy into that. So working with the Debian community, working with other distributions effectively to raise the bar in package management. Because you see, in the free software world, we don't have to think in terms of shrink-wrapped applications that you go out and fetch from somewhere with a price attached to them, or with a toll gate attached to them. We should think in terms of, I want to get this job done right now. And when you say, I want to get this job done right now, the software should just be there, because it will all be free software. And so we need a package management infrastructure which effectively allows you to do that, allows you to say, okay, now I want to do some real-time multimedia editing, and have the software just there as if you'd installed it, as if you'd gone out and chosen the right application and bought it and so on. So that's kind of where we're headed. The other thing that I think we're going to see over the next 6 to 12 months is just enormous growth in the free software community, and particularly around Ubuntu and Kubuntu. Just if we look at the charts of the number of developers and so on, it's really growing as a community. And the challenge for us will be to try and keep the social cohesiveness of a project as the number of people rises. Okay. So I said a little while ago that I think collaboration is the glue, right? Collaboration is the essence of the free software movement. And one of the things that we've been working hard to do is to try and make sure that when we do stuff, we can do it in as collaborative a way as possible. So I spoke a little bit about Malone. Malone is the bug tracker that we wrote for Ubuntu, but we wrote it in such a way that other projects, other distributions, can actually take advantage of it as well. So I think that's over here. So this is an example of a bug report in Ubuntu, which is actually also an upstream bug report. So over here you can see the status of this bug in Ubuntu. It's confirmed. Sebastian's not going to get to it, but Sebastian's the person responsible for it. And you can see which package it's in over here in Ubuntu. This is the status of the same bug upstream, right? I can tell you that it's been reported in the GNOME Bugzilla, and it's bug number 162177. And at the moment, it's unconfirmed. If someone in the Bugzilla community, in the GNOME community, changes the status on that bug in the GNOME Bugzilla, that status will change here as well. And so what we're trying to move towards is the idea where we can have a seamless conversation between all of the people who are affected by a particular bug. Sometimes bugs affect different packages. So you can imagine that if there's a security bug in, say, libz, right, in the compression library, that code is included in lots of different applications. Lots of different applications all have to be conscious of the fact that they need to make sure that they've got a fix for that, otherwise they potentially expose security vulnerabilities to their users. So sometimes these conversations happen within the distro, but across multiple packages. Sometimes they happen across distros, right? We all face the same bug, right? We've all got the same security bug in X that we have to fix. So we have to be able to track at any one time what the status of that bug is in multiple distros. And of course, sometimes it affects upstreams as well. So the idea is to try and build a collaborative bug tracker, which allows us to have those conversations in sort of meaningful kind of ways, which doesn't force people to change their tools. So we've gone to a lot of work here to make sure that the GNOME guys can keep their Bugzilla. Right? They want to work in that Bugzilla, that's great. But it also allows upstreams to use the same platform to bounce ideas around between themselves and the distributions which are effectively helping them debug their code. There's an enormous inefficiency at the moment in the free software world between upstream and between the distributions. And it's very frustrating to me because I know that up in Redmond and up in Cupertino, if an application developer finds an issue, right, he's able to go in the kernel. He's able to pass that issue over to the kernel guys without leaving his desk, without having to go create a new account somewhere, without having to learn a new language, figure out new mailing lists or any of that stuff. He just says, hey, this is an issue that belongs to you guys. And the kernel guys then take a look at it and figure out what they're going to do. And we need that same level of collaboration in the free software world. Similarly, I think I've got everything there. The idea is to create this cross-project conversation with email interfaces so that people can just work within email, replying to messages that they get and so on, and with XML RPC interfaces so that you can programmatically talk to the bug tracker directly. Rosetta is a similar platform, right? The idea is to create translation collaboration because, again, we have so much duplication of work between upstreams and between distributions. So the idea there is try and create a common database of translations. If someone wants to come and translate upstreams, then those translations are immediately available to everybody else. If someone, not just in distributions, but also in other applications, right? So if I introduce a string, hello world, in an application, in my application, and that gets translated into Catalan for my application. If someone else has that same string in their application, then the Catalan translator will immediately see recommended to them that Catalan translation from a completely different application. So the idea is to try and create collaboration in translation across projects upstream and between upstream and distributions. I think I can show you a little bit of that as well. This is the kind of user interface here. So this is an upstream application that's using Rosetta, and what you can see is that it's actually become quite widely translated. Now, purple translations are translations that are brand new in Rosetta, so they haven't yet been published by these guys in their upstream CVSs. Red translations are things that haven't been translated anywhere. Green translations are translations that exist in the upstream CVS, so there's nothing new in Rosetta there. And then there'll be some blue translations, which are translations which have been changed effectively, where someone's gone and they say, okay, the upstream, the CVS translation is wrong. We need to improve that. So the idea is to give communities this kind of tool so that this is a tracker. Here we have a distro view of the same thing. this kind of tool so that they can effectively coordinate their translations independently of their developers. So the developers can just focus on development, translators can translate, and translators can move across applications and distributions seamlessly. Okay, so this is now the same thing for languages. You can see across the whole distribution, and I think we're probably the first people ever to do this. This is the whole of Ubuntu, right? KDE, GNOME, XFCE, server stuff, all the translations you can imagine across all languages. And you can see, that's for Hori, I could do for Dapper as well. You can see how translated we are. Now, if you look at this chart, we have a long way to go, right? I have to just switch over here. I can see what I'm doing. We have a long way to go in the translation game, right? Because I'll just switch that again so it doesn't flutter. There are relatively few languages that are extremely well translated. And if we want to meet that goal of providing a platform that I can give my... Where's my mouse? Have I lost it? Somebody file a bug, would you? I've lost my mouse. Somebody find me a rat. Okay. So if we want to meet the goal of giving people a platform which is widely translated, then we have to have this kind of infrastructure. Okay. The other area where I think we can do a lot better as a community is in project planning, right? We need to be able to give our customers, our end users, a real sense of what they can expect to happen in the next month, in the next 6 months, in the next year. And that's one of the most difficult things for the free software community to do, because what we're good at doing, what we're good at doing is working individually on the things that we care about. It's very difficult to predict effectively then what is going to happen in 6 months' time or in a year's time. So we had a fantastically productive meeting this morning with the KDE community, and guys there were saying that As an organization, as a community, KDE is having to learn effectively how to project out and communicate to new developers and new users what needs to be done, what their priorities are, what the priorities aren't. That's how you build a robust and vibrant community. And so we're starting to try and do the same sort of thing. We call that blueprint, effectively. That's how we manage the distribution. Every 6 months, we try and get all of our developers together, and we say, come on, guys, come up with a blueprint. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just needs to map out roughly what features we can expect you to be working on over the next 6 months. And then we let everybody go off and work independently, individually, in that free software kind of way, but report back effectively just through that simple interface how they're doing on the stuff that they care about. And so what that allows us to do effectively is create a picture, a unique picture of the state of the distribution at any given time. So I can show you that here. This is basically the project plan for Dapper, which is due June 1st. And you can see all the stuff that 7 months ago we committed to do, right, is all of these specifications up here. And you can see the status of any particular application and the work that still needs to be done. If necessary, I can go in and show the work that needs to be done on a particular application to get it, to get it working. So this allows our community effectively to know where they can help most, because they can see which things are the most important and which are behind development. So that allows your community to climb in and participate effectively. So what we hope is that, again, we've built all of this infrastructure for ourselves, but we hope that other projects will start to use it as well, so that they can project for their users what to expect in 6 months' time, what to expect in a year's time. It helps you to shape the conversation, to build a community, to get people who can't be full-time professionals in the free software world but can make good contributions, just to know which contributions are going to be most important at any given time. Okay. The last sort of big new piece of technology which we're very focused on is something called distributed revision control. Now, this is when one of the trigger points for me in deciding to start Ubuntu was that I saw that we were going to, that we'd reached the limit of what we could do with kind of centralized revision control. And it was time to really turn that around and do something new. And distributed revision control really allows communities to function at a whole new level of productivity. Essentially, the way traditional revision control works is that you have a centralized repository of work. And so everybody around the internet can look at that and see where the code stands at any given time. And so as people make changes to that code, everybody gets to watch those changes being made. The problem is that often when we're developing features, we need to be able to work on our own for a while. It takes time to develop something before it reaches the point where it's ready to go and share with everybody else. And with traditional tools, as soon as you started to work on stuff that was either private or which wasn't yet ready to be part of the mainline code base, you lost the ability to collaborate with other people, and you lost the ability to keep good records of what you've done at any given time. And distributed revision control basically allows you to do that. Projects can keep a mainline branch, right, a trunk of development. We call that the trunk. But then individuals can say, okay, now I'm branching off that on my local laptop, and I'm going to work locally on a new feature that I'm developing, and I'm going to get locally, I'll be able to commit locally, I'll be able to store a full revision log, be able to go back and undo my changes, I'll be able to publish to other people the changes that I'm making. I'll be able to go and get collaboration on this branch here from a guy over there and a guy over there who's also interested in the same feature. And so essentially, instead of having this rigid lock effectively on what goes in at any one time, what the whole community gets to work on, you allow the community to work in the way that it best suits it, which is in this highly parallelized kind of fashion. Now, of course, if you do that, you'll then also have to have some of the planning stuff that I was describing earlier in place, because otherwise you can end up with chaos, right? You need to sort of roughly know what's important, what's not important, so that the various big pieces do come back together in an efficient kind of way. The research and development that we've been doing on that is now turned into something called BZR, and version 0.8 is released this weekend. And I really urge you guys to go and check it out. bzr-vcs.org is where you'll find it, or just Google for bizarre version control system. And BZR 0.8 really, I think, represents the kind of culmination of a huge amount of work in trying to give the free software community a freely available tool that doesn't have any of the intellectual property issues of BitKeeper or something like that, which is very usable for new communities and new users. It's designed to be straightforward, to feel easy to use, which doesn't require any fancy infrastructure to get up and running, but again, which allows communities to work in this parallel fashion very, very efficiently. So I think that's important, because right now we're not getting the most out of all of our developers, right? Think how many times you have a hot young developer who gets really interested in a project, comes along, and realizes that it's going to take him 6 to 8 months before he gets the recognition from the project leaders that he needs to be able to get commit access to their CVS or Subversion repositories, right? And so after 2-3 months of that, he says, you know what, I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to start my own project or do something else different. In fact, what we really want is we want that guy, when he shows up, to be able to branch immediately and start working on the things that he cares about and publish the diffs effectively and build a community around his ideas. And as his ideas come to prominence, as he's able to prove them, as he's able to show the technology, as the more senior members of the project are able to get comfortable with him, they can then land his work into the mainline trunk. So this really is, I think, a transformational technology. One of the things that from a community point of view, from a workflow collaboration productivity point of view, is going to really change things. Okay. What is our biggest challenge in the free software community? I think our biggest challenge is not to be judged by the mistakes that were made previously, all right? Or not to be judged by the constraints of history. The traditional, the PC environment, the desktop environment as we know it today, evolved under very different circumstances to what we face today. In 1980, the best way to build a desktop OS was to hire the smartest guys you could, stick them in one campus somewhere far away from anything exciting, and Redmond, Washington would count, right? And put them into a hotbed to produce something amazing. And Microsoft did that. They did that beautifully, right? Let's not give credit where credit is due. They produced the best platform at the time. I believe that actually history has moved on. Today we face completely different constraints, right? And our biggest constraints are on our ability to organize and collaborate across time zones, across the internet, across ways of working. If we can overcome those constraints, we can actually deliver not something that is constrained by history and was designed for historical purposes, but something which actually is right and ready for the 21st century. And so our biggest challenge effectively is not to be judged against what's gone before, but in our own minds to say, what's possible with free software? What are the things that we can do that nobody else would think to do because they were stuck in one economic paradigm or they're stuck in one technological paradigm? And we should play to those strengths, right? Instead of beating up on ourselves and saying, oh, you know, we'll never win this game because we can't do these things that Microsoft can do, right? Instead of doing that, we should turn the game around. We should say, hey, there are a couple of things that we can do that nobody else can do. And play to those strengths. Play ruthlessly to those strengths because that is how we will win. So, that's just about all the prattling that you need from me. I hope that was interesting, and I'm really looking forward to your questions. Can I?
So, do we have some time for questions? Any questions to Mark? Could you please stand up before you ask?
Sure, I can do so. Ubuntu, being a desktop distribution, is very dependent on features like video drivers, network sound drivers, etc. Do you actively approach hardware vendors about providing drivers for Linux, as this seems to be a key item for getting success on the desktop?
Yeah, so that's one of the areas where we have to work hardest. Anybody here work for Broadcom? Because I'm just in the process of exchanging email and trying very hard to get permission to include some firmware from Broadcom in Ubuntu so that Wi-Fi cards from Broadcom can work right out of the box. So that's one of the most sort of difficult ongoing conversations that we have. Here's the good news. The good news is that this is entirely a market-driven phenomenon, and the momentum is on our side. If you look at just the numbers of Linux desktops that are shipping around the world, right, we are creeping towards the point at which the sales start to matter. So we will get to the point where if ATI can stand up and say, guys, free software drivers end-to-end, right, and large numbers of us say, right, I'm going to buy ATI video cards as a result, then that will show up on ATI's sales figures, and it'll show up on their competition sales figures as well in the wrong kind of way. And that kind of pressure is what will ultimately tip the scales in our favor. We're almost there. I absolutely believe it. We're almost there. But it is possibly the most difficult thing. It's also the one area where, sad to say, we compromise on the free software principles. We ship proprietary drivers because we believe that hardware enablement is what gives people the ability to run and experience the free software world. But I can't wait for the day when we can say, done, you lost three manufacturers, you lose. It's time to get with the rest of them and do this as free software.
Hello, Mark. You were mentioning large desktop installations within companies, big companies or government organizations. The key thing, in my opinion, is to make large desktop installations maintainable. Do you have any concepts for this in the drawer or anything in mind?
Right. So ultimately what you're saying is that it's an economic proposition, right? The economics have to work out for it to be sustainable.
No, I'm talking about technical propositions.
Well, those two things come together because you can achieve anything given either time or money, right? So really what you're talking about is, can we make this economically sustainable? Can we make it maintainable, technically maintainable, at a reasonable price? Right. And yes, I believe that we absolutely can do that. That's also why it's important for us to invest in even better technology for package management, for example, so that across a very large organization, you can have very good control over what security updates are deployed on what days to which desktops. I believe, ultimately, free software will make technology in general much more maintainable and much more cost effective. And if you look at some of the very large scale deployments of technology in education, they can only exist using free software because the economics just flat out don't work any other way. But what we need to do is to kind of bring those economics together with the commercial level of service that people expect from Windows and from the Mac into something which is genuinely free. So it's tricky, but I think we'll get there.
Okay.
Hello, Mark. Could you tell us about the Ubuntu Foundation, what it does and its relationship to Canonical?
Okay. The Ubuntu Foundation is basically a trust that exists that I put money into as a fallback in case we can't make the core distribution sustainable. Why is that? We're making commitments to people. We're promising that we will provide support for Dapper for 5 years on the server, and that will cost money to do. So in my mind, the only way I can do that with integrity is if I say that there is money set aside to do that if I get hit by a bus or anything else happens to Canonical. There's enough money in the Ubuntu Foundation to meet all of the commitments we've made to our users. And so essentially it exists as a fallback to make sure that we absolutely can meet all of our commitments. We try not to use the money in the foundation. We try to fund everything that we do it through Canonical effectively, because that's our best chance of getting to sustainability. But the foundation exists essentially as a fallback so that there are funds available to cover the costs of meeting support, security, and other commitments for each of the releases that we make.
Hi, Mark. First of all, thank you for giving Ubuntu to the world. My question is a little bit similar to the last one. You told about the tools that are developed, and are those tools are going to be open source tools or not? And is all the infrastructure that you build with those tools owned by Ubuntu, or are some of the parts of the infrastructure assets of Canonical?
Right.
Besides the know-how, the people and
right.
the vision you have there.
So some parts do belong to Canonical. And those parts relate to Canonical sustainability, which is, for example, offering services to other companies who want to customize Ubuntu. So we have a huge amount of expertise in how Ubuntu is put together and so on. What we know is that people will want to take Ubuntu and make custom versions of it for different purposes, sometimes for embedding on a particular device, sometimes for, you know, doctors in Spain. They want to produce a custom version of Ubuntu for doctors in Spain, sometimes for teachers in Brazil, right? And what we believe we can do is, using some technology that we own, we can help them do that in a very efficient way. So that when we make a security patch, that patch automatically flows through to them if they haven't changed the packages. Or if they need to integrate that into a changed package that they've got, that those tools make it very easy for them to do it. So essentially what we want to do is offer those services to companies who make a living out of modifying and customizing Ubuntu. They don't have to use them. But that is part of the sustainability strategy of Canonical. And so as a result, those tools are proprietary to Canonical. Most of the other stuff that we do is free software. So Bazaar, for example, is free software. And we have a very strong feeling that anything that goes into the distro, anything that we ask people to run, anything that you might install with that CD, it's all free software. So for example, we'll launch a web-based management and monitoring solution, similar to Red Hat Network and others, for Ubuntu. And all of the clients, all the stuff that you actually install on your machine there, all of that stuff's free software. But the server end, the web-based stuff that we manage and maintain, that stuff we'll keep internal to Canonical. So we have to draw that distinction, and effectively always make sure that we're giving back to the free software community all the pieces where we've added value, but retaining the things which give us a competitive positioning that will make the distro sustainable. Fresh out of questions. Well, then let me say, one last question over here.
Okay. So what I appreciate about free software is that people start to work together, where in other parts of this world, they just block themselves with all kinds of barriers. So I'd like to know your thoughts about extending these free software ideals, not just to other distros, but to other areas of this world, like industry or like other things, if there is any, or abolishing nations or stuff like that.
So
frontiers, I mean.
That's a really interesting question. It kind of returns to the philosophy of what all this is about. And I tend to believe that powerful ideas win. You guys know what I know about a meme? A meme is like an idea gene, right? And just like genes spread through society, some of us spread more than others, but memes spread through society, like ideas spread through society, and powerful ideas tend to spread faster. Sometimes there's a big battle, right? But ultimately the most powerful idea at the time wins. And collaboration and sharing are very powerful ideas, always have been. But today with the internet, we can collaborate in much more efficient ways than we ever used to be able to collaborate. More importantly, it used to be that you could only ever collaborate with people that you were physically close to, right, in your neighborhood, right? How many kernel hackers live in your street, right? Not that many, right? But globally, lots of kernel hackers, right? And so on the internet, we're able to form these communities where previously you just couldn't get that kind of traction. The same is happening in all sorts of other areas. So I was asked about DRM, for example. DRM is an idea. I won't judge the idea. All I will say is that I don't think it's nearly as powerful as the idea of widespread distribution and collaborative content creation, right? DRM is not rights management, it's copy control, right? Call it what it is. And the truth is that if you put toll gates and barriers in front of your users all the time, and there's another group of users who have no toll gates and barriers, first, these guys are going to do far more interesting stuff. And second, these guys, pretty soon, are going to figure out they want to be over here. And so we're seeing that right now in the music industry, right? Because the content owners there were so terrified of copying that they allowed themselves to get sold on the idea of DRM, on copy control, effectively. They've effectively handed the keys of their industry to one manufacturer. Right? Because 70% of the music that's sold today will only play on one manufacturer's hardware. Right? You know who I'm talking about. Right? I got a couple of them. So the point being that from an industry perspective, what that's done to the music industry is it means that they've effectively handed over power to that one manufacturer because they were afraid, because of fear of copy control. Think about what the music industry really wants. The music industry really wants to have their content as widely available as possible and to make it as easy as possible for honest people who want to pay, right? I have no problem paying for music, none whatsoever, right? I can afford it, right? I'm gonna enjoy it. And if they make it absolutely easy for me to do, why wouldn't I, right? And most people actually behave that way. So what the music industry should be doing, my pitch to the music industry, is make your music work, put no DRM in the way so that whatever player someone's running on, your music can get to them. Whatever operating system someone's running, your music can get to them. Whatever radio station someone's listening to, your music can get to them, right? The 21st century is all about distribution. And DRM is just a dumb idea if you look at it from a distribution perspective. Does that answer? Okay. Passionate stuff, this.
Yeah. Okay, if nobody else has a serious question, I may have an unserious, funny one to end. First of all, I haven't already. I want to thank you for this great OS you brought out. And secondly, I was wondering, just sitting here, has anybody ever recommended you to put your initials in front of Ubuntu?
My initials are MRS. Right, Mark Richard Shuttleworth, and the original company name, when you start a company, if you're doing it in a hurry, basically what you do is people register companies, they're called off-the-shelf companies, and you just grab one of those off-the-shelf companies, and they all have sort of their own names, so you kind of inherit their names. Anyway, so the bank created an off-the-shelf company for us called Virtual Development Limited, right? And in fact, they called it MRS, Virtual Development Limited, which turns into Mrs. VD, which was totally inappropriate. So no, I wouldn't stick my initials anywhere near Ubuntu. It's just dangerous. Anyway, so thank you very much, guys. It's been fantastic to be here. It's been wonderful to interact more directly with the KDE community. You guys are awesome. And I really think this is an amazing forum. I hope that this forum sort of continues to set the pace for discussions and talking about the free software movement. So thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.